Let's go.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Tapp, and this is the DNA of Purpose podcast, where we explore purpose as a part of who we already are. We showcase all inspiring stories of the most purpose-driven people on the planet with the intention of giving you the tools to step into the potential of who you were always born to be. After all, it's in your DNA. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. Now, up until today's interview, I had never heard of the word the Anthropocene, but since learning of this word, it's had me thinking a lot about why we are seeking out purpose in our lives at this time, more so than ever before. Now, for those of you like me who had never heard of the Anthropocene, it defines Earth's most recent geologic time period as being human-influenced, based on overwhelming global evidence that atmospheric, geologic, hydrologic, biospheric, and other Earth system processes are now fundamentally altered by humans. Now, this thought is both terrifying and hopeful, depending on your perception. I have to say it's incredibly difficult to absorb the fact that scientists predict that human effects on the planet will be seen in the fossil record as far away as 10 or even 100 million years. But the one thing we can be responsible for at this particular point is becoming more aware and conscious of our impact in the Anthropocene, in that the future needs us now more than ever. And now is the time where we can take ownership of the impact that we are creating. And that brings me to the topic of today's conversation and, of course, today's guest. Her name is Gaia Vince, and she is the author of two books, Adventures in the Anthropocene, and also the topic of today's conversation, Transcendence, How Humans Evolved Through Fire, Language, Beauty, and Time. Gaia Vince is an award-winning science journalist, author, broadcaster, and a speaker with a focus on how human systems and Earth's planetary systems interact. She's, as I've mentioned, an author, and she's written a slew of articles from names such as the BBC, The Guardian, New Scientist, Australian Geographic, and Science. Now, over the course of today's episode, Gaia explains how through four elements, fire, language, beauty, and time, our species diverged from the evolutionary path of all other animals to become who we are today. She explores how a primate took dominion over nature and turned itself into something marvelous. Gaia believes that we are living in a unique time in Earth's history in which climate change, globalization, communications technology, and increasing human populations are changing our world and also changing us as never before. So, as always, grab yourself a coffee or tea, maybe some lemon and honey in my case, as I'm battling a little bit of a scratchy throat, if you can hear that. Strap yourself in because we are definitely going on a journey through fire, language, beauty, and time with the one and only Gaia Vince. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. Gaia Vince, such a pleasure to have you beaming into the studio for the DNA of Purpose podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's such a pleasure, such a pleasure.
Well, look, I feel extremely lucky to speak to you and broadly speaking, that I get to speak with some of the most purpose-driven and intelligent people on the planet because of this podcast. So with that in mind, I'm always interested to know and ask my guests if there's any one idea, trend or tool that you have stumbled across or that you've been thinking about recently that you believe will significantly influence the creation of a better future.
Well, I think what my research has shown me is the importance of cooperation and collaboration. So it's hugely important throughout evolution. It's a tool that evolution uses all the time. You can see that with our body's cells. They cooperate together to produce this organism that works, that functions, even though each cell is doing a different job. You can see that with different animal societies, from ants to bees and so on. But humans really have taken that to this entirely new level. We cooperate with each other, even if we're not related, even if it's got no genetic advantage. We still cooperate, and we now cooperate globally. We've seen that with the pandemic, how we follow stay at home orders, how we wear masks to protect each other in public, and all these little niceties that we perform, not because there's a military person standing outside our door threatening to shoot us if we don't, but because we are very social, very cooperative, very collaborative people. And we know, our genes know, even if we're not cognitively aware, that our survival depends on the survival of all of us, of our group. We depend on our group for our survival, but for everything that we have, that our entire lives are dependent on others and people that we're not related to, people we might never, ever meet. And that has made us this incredibly successful creature that we are. And that is the key to our future. We face global challenges now, whether it's pandemics or global climate change or biodiversity loss. These are things that we can only solve as a global community. We can make differences to our own neighborhoods, and that's really important. But when we're talking about these huge global challenges, we can only do that by collaborating with complete strangers in other countries and changing the way that we live. And no other animal would do that.
And also, you know, within that, just our ability to celebrate diversity by design, to come up with new solutions within those collaborations and the manner in which we cooperate. I mean, I don't know if we always get this right, but in theory, it's a nice idea.
Yeah, diversity is hugely important, and it's important throughout evolution. Without diversity, you see an end to a gene pool. That's what happens. That's what happens quite often when animals go extinct. It's because the gene pool is so reduced that you don't have that diversity. You don't have that healthy mixture of genes and adaptations to allow you to survive any different environment, whether that's a new disease or whether it's a change in climate or food availability or anything. And that's just completely true as well for human societies. If you look at where human societies are most diverse and most collaborative, that's our cities. And cities are what led civilization and led technological change. And we see that throughout the way that humans network. The networking ability is most concentrated in cities, but of course we've always networked. Small hunter-gatherer societies always network, because if they don't, they go extinct. And we've got examples of where societies have lost diversity. They've lost that input of new ideas or new genes or new technologies. When they lose that, that new way of thinking, that diversity, that pool of ideas that allow them to have knowledge about where there is water availability, or how to hunt an animal, or where to find food during a drought. When you lose that diversity of knowledge, then you can't survive as a group, and you certainly can't survive as an individual. So diversity is hugely important. It's also more interesting, I think, than everybody looking and sounding and behaving in exactly the same way. That becomes kind of a bit cultish.
Definitely. We don't want to copy each other that much.
No.
And Gaia, I know that you are really passionate about how human systems and Earth's planetary systems interact. So I guess I want to jump backwards before moving forwards in today's podcast, so I can understand how this purpose for you came about, where it was born. And one thing I have noticed in having, probably hundreds of conversations now with a variety of different people about purpose is often it is something that is catalyzed or crystallized in like a turning point moment, or in some cases, a series of turning point moments. When you look back over the course of your life, was there any one particular moment, or there might have been, you know, several, where you were like, right, this is my dharma, this is what I'm here for?
I guess I've always been very curious and very interested. So, you know, I have a science background. I started with science, but I've also traveled a lot, and I've always been interested in people from different cultures. And so they have fed through and really sort of they've helped inform they've helped inform the sort of the science understanding that I have has been informed by the human understanding, because they are, you can't see them as separate. And I think it's a big mistake to separate these disciplines and to not realize that science is, it is social and it is political, and it is not simply a rational tool. It's so much more than that, because it's made and invented by humans and used by humans, and humans are ultimately not not an algorithm. We are not an algorithm. And there have been quite a lot of books recently basically claiming that that's how the brain works, that we are algorithms, and sometimes these things go wrong. We're not. I mean, I totally disagree with that.
And what a big assumption to suggest we even know that much about the brain yet.
Well, indeed. And the more that we discover and the more we learn about the brain, the more surprising it is that we actually even manage to stand up and breathe, frankly, let alone anything else. So I think I've always been very interested in the environment and how that's changing, and the human role in that, and also how that is affecting humans. So I worked at the journal Nature for a while, and then I left that job to really have a look at this huge change that's going on as we enter the Anthropocene, this enormous transformation. So I was getting a lot of papers coming in about climate change, about species extinctions, about humans moving enormous amounts of sediment. And I realized that there is one kind of nexus for all of this, and it's humans. We are creating all of this. And so I wanted to see how that's affecting people and what they're doing about it. So I left and went on a 2.5-year journey around the world, mainly around the global south, visiting everywhere from sort of remote communities to capitals to laboratories to farmlands, and just to find out, really, as we enter this incredibly new sort of world, this new era, the Anthropocene.
So can you tell us a bit more about, because that was actually my next question. So I love that you're diving into this, but I certainly hadn't heard of the Anthropocene until doing my research for today's interview. So I'd love to understand a little bit more about what the Anthropocene is all about.
Yeah, sure. So it was an idea that came up. A chemist called Paul Crutzen in the Netherlands was sitting in a conference one day, and they were talking about the geological era that we're supposed to be in is the Holocene, which is this era of very stable climate and warmer climate as we exited the last ice age, the Pleistocene. So most of human evolution has taken place in the Pleistocene, actually, in ice ages. But all of civilization, farming, writing, cities, advanced tool making, all of that has taken place since then in this much warmer climate of the Holocene, when populations could grow bigger and we could do that very important networking. So he was sitting there and they were talking about, you know, this unusual temperature for the Holocene and this unusual rainfall pattern for the Holocene and all this sort of thing. And he just stood up and said, we're not in the Holocene anymore. We've left the Holocene now. We're in the Anthropocene. He just sort of came up with this name. And it was kind of a minor little thing, but it really, you know, it didn't get a lot of publicity. It wasn't this huge kind of moment at all. But it really struck a chord with me. And I thought, you know, he's right. This is, we have changed. This is everything change. It's not just climate change. It's not just, biodiversity loss. It's not just sort of the loss of lions or tigers or something. It's the fact that eucalyptus trees are everywhere now. They're not just in, you know, one indigenous spot. Kiwi fruit are grown across the world. Cats are in Australia and New Zealand. We've changed everything. We've transformed our planet. We use 4/5 of it just to grow our food. You think of that. I mean, it's extraordinary. The changes that we've made are really dramatic, and it's pushed our planet into a new geological era, into the Anthropocene, the world that's dominated by humans. And that was a really kind of profound moment for me, this realization. And that's really what I wanted to talk about. So I ended up writing about this new world that we're entering and how it will affect us. It's already affecting us. And what we're going to do about it. And so that was my first book, Adventures in the Anthropocene.
Thank you for sharing your ideas on this, because for me it was a real realization, because I hadn't heard of the term. But what I love about it is, firstly, just in talking about this, becoming more aware and conscious human beings. And I almost feel like by sort of naming this as an age, as a period that we're entering, it kind of helps us to put a story to our impact. And in creating a story around that, it allows us to be more responsible and more accountable to how we are impacting the planet today.
Yeah, I think it's really important to name things, because that's how we understand the world. We understand the world through things that we name, things that we have words for, because language is so intrinsic in how we process cognitively the world around us. And also the stories that we create and the stories that we understand. And the Anthropocene is a very powerful story because really our lives take place in with a backdrop of climate and environment that we might not even be aware of, but it completely, you know, the types of weather that we live through, the types of foods that are available, whether the weather is extreme or pleasant. I think it was a huge wake-up call in British Columbia, in Canada, to have temperatures hotter than the Sahara Desert. That's a massive and dramatic change to the lives of people, even if they, you know, even if they survived the heat wave, which sadly killed people, more than 100 people. But even if they survived the heat wave and relatively unscathed, that is it's a different backdrop to their lives now. You know, the very reliable weather that we almost unconsciously don't know that we're living through is changing. And of course, Australia has very dramatic weather anyway. But I think the bushfires of Black Summer, again, was something that will have changed the fabric of people's life, the backdrop to their lives. The idea that you live for months with terrible air pollution, that you can't breathe properly, where the sky is a different colour. These are, even if we don't recognise them immediately, these are fundamental changes to how we experience our environment. And it's, yeah, this is the new normal. This is,
yeah,
this
and is to what your will point, it changes normal. Us.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It changes us because we are a product of our environment. So if our environment changes, we have to adapt to it. And yeah, yeah, it's a dramatic shift in our understanding of our place in the world and how to behave in our landscape, because we don't have another one. There isn't another world.
Yeah, so this is
our changed world.
Yeah. And you mentioned before that you had travelled around the world for 800 days, I believe, to see what life is really like for people on the front line of the planet that we have created. And I know that you visited like the artificial glaciers in the Himalayas, the painted mountains in Peru, electrified reefs in the Maldives, to garbage islands in the Caribbean. So I'm sure, in the context of all of those adventures, and there were probably many more, there would have been one or two stories that when you think back on your adventures traveling, maybe still give you goosebumps. Do you have a story to share from those adventures?
Yeah, it was an incredible journey. I mean, it was a lot more than 800 days, actually. I wrote about it at 800 days. But it was actually, it was more than 2.5 years. So it was a very long journey. Yes, I mean, there's lots and lots of stories. Surviving gun-toting bandits in Turkana, in the tribal lands of northern Kenya and southern Ethiopia. That was during this horrible drought when there was no water. That was a scary but fascinating time. People who really live on the edge of, they really live on the edge of their environment. Pastoralists who don't have water, they don't have really enough of anything, and so they survive very much by stealing each other's goats or whatever they have. And it's a violent, lawless place, and it's changing. It's changing massively, and I think that way of life is slowly growing extinct. In that place, actually, since I was there, they're building the world's, well, Africa's. I think it's one of the. It was the biggest when they signed the deal, but it will be one of the biggest wind farms. And so these people who have no electricity, their lives are going to gradually be transformed. It's going to be a different world for them. And I think that's really interesting. I think that's one of the potentials that renewable energy has, in that it is very decentralized, essentially. So instead of having to fork out for enormous power stations, a coal powered station or an oil powered station in a center, these can be smaller and smaller and located to actually serve the communities, which will change. It will change the way of life for
it's
people
literally
all over the
like
world.
Literally giving power back to the people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's high time, because there's an enormous number of people who still don't have access to electricity. And this means that children can't study. They can't cool themselves in these terrible temperatures that we're all experiencing now. Everything from irrigating crops or getting clean water, cooking, all these things are impossible. And you have to remember that in the tropics, it gets dark at 6 p.m. So, you know, from 6 p.m., there's no light unless they're burning expensive kerosene, which is all sorts of environmental repercussions. So,
solar
power
as well.
Has this enormous role to play in really alleviating poverty. It's quite exciting to see.
So I want to have a chat about your second book, Transcendence, or, you know, to be specific, what I want to talk about is how humankind transcended to give rise to, I guess, the Anthropocene, really. In the book, the first chapter is titled Genesis. So I guess for those listeners out there who might be keen for a little science lesson, I was wondering if we could go for a wander through, you know, how we went from being made of star stuff, I guess, to then becoming smart apes before somehow transforming into a planet-dominating force. So if you could take us down that road. it's a big question. I know we could go very far down the road. But
yeah. So, well, life began in the oceans. More than 3 billion years ago in stromolites. You can actually see there are some stromolites, I think, in WA somewhere that still exist. And these are very, very ancient form of algae. They weren't the first life form, but they were the first ones that actually gave rise to oxygen and allowed, they transformed. Next, backtrack, because that wasn't quite true.
We're good. We can cut and edit that bit.
it's quite a big ask. So, yeah, life began in the oceans, and for actually billions of years, there wasn't anything bigger than a few cells floating around. And then through cooperation, this is what drove more complex life forms. Cells got together and cooperated with each other, and some actually incorporated other cells within them, other life forms within them, and then you got more complicated organisms. But it took an awful lot of time and many different geological eras, different climate changes for any sort of mammal to evolve. And eventually we got primates, which were kind of spurred by, again, geological change and like the African Rift Valley, the rising of the Himalayas and things like that, all led to complexity among primates. We got apes, and then we got the first humans. And humans are an interesting primate that do seem to be driven initially, even very far back, by brain size. So that is something, we don't have the biggest brains for our bodies. We don't have the biggest brains of any animal, but the way we use our brains is quite interesting. We're very, very social, so we're able to learn from each other and rely on each other. And so that gives us a kind of efficiency of scale.
Mm.
And really, it was with the evolution of Homo erectus, which is a sort of an intelligent, upright, walking ancestor of ours that lived in Africa and then spread around the world, that we get the first sort of recognizable human thought. Like Homo erectus could make fire. Mm. Sophisticated tools, was able to travel around, which means that they were very adaptable.
Did they socialize? And
yes, they definitely would have relied on each other, because that's the only way that a hairless, fairly puny animal of that size could survive. And really, that ability to harness fire is what changed our species, because every species on Earth is limited by how much energy it can produce or energy that it can harness. So plants get their energy from the sun by photosynthesizing, which is a not very dense form of energy. It's very useful. They can use it to grow and they can make different adaptations, and some plants can move slightly. But, you know, a photosynthesizing animal can't run and hunt.
Mm.
So by eating the plants, you get a more dense form of energy and so on. And so we were limited, like any other animal, to how much energy we could produce. Brains are very, very, very hungry organs. So they need a lot of energy for cognitive processing, because it's actually very energy. It's a very energy intensive process, thinking, which is why I need to do it quite often lying down with my eyes closed. That's what I tell my children anyway. But once
or
we
eat
harness
more
fire,
food.
Yeah, once we harnessed fire, what we got was an external source of energy, and that really revolutionized the trajectory of humans, because what we were doing is we were offloading the effort of making concentrated food. So instead of our guts having to digest plant matter or animal meat or whatever, the fire cooked it, and that does a lot of the digestion for us. Cooking breaks down the fibrous tissues and produces chemicals that are much easier for us to digest. So we have a much more efficient, and it makes sources of energy that aren't available to us available because through chemical changes. So that was that really increased the efficiency of our lives, because we had suddenly a much better source of energy. And also it means that we didn't have to spend, you know, 5 to 6 to 7 hours of our day literally just chewing food or finding food and digesting it, which most other animals have to do. We just have a sandwich and we're fueled. Because all that meat, all that food has been processed, you know, the grains have been cooked into a bread and so on. So all that has been done for us. It's the same with heating ourselves. Fire provides that. Fire provides light. Fire provides protection. Mm. All these things are otherwise tasks that take an enormous amount of energy. So that incredibly harnessing fire completely transformed our lives. And
so can I ask two questions there? Because I know in the book you have a very in-depth chapter on fire. And what was interesting for me in reading that, firstly, was that there was a time when Earth, even though it was formed within the sun, couldn't sustain flames, that fire didn't actually exist. So if we backtrack a little bit, firstly, fire had to come about. And then from there, humans had to learn how to make fire. Can you share with me how that came about?
Yeah, so fire... There have been times in Earth's history where fires were very, very rare and couldn't be sustained, because fire itself is a reaction that requires a fuel. So there was a time when there weren't burnable things. There weren't trees. So there just wasn't enough stuff to burn. It also requires oxygen. So there were times when the oxygen concentration of the air was just too low. Fires would just go out immediately if they even sparked. And it also requires a certain temperature, an ignition temperature. So if it's too cold, it's very hard to sustain fires as well. So you need all three of those at once. And so we're lucky that that humans evolved at a time when those three things were available. Mm. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to do that. And really, our whole evolution has been about harnessing energy. And we've just got better and better and better at harnessing energy, to the extent that I can press a button with my little finger and enormous things can happen. Mm. You know, that's how good we are now. So we basically went from the Stone Age to today. Literally, the whole journey was about harnessing energy in various ways. And that's what's driven our societies. That's the most energy efficient way of organizing ourselves. It's what's driven language acquisition. That's the most energy efficient way of sharing information with each other. Mm. And sharing information is the most energy efficient way of, again, organizing societies and getting things done. Yeah, so the journey began with fire, and presumably, you know, our ancient ancestors before Homo erectus, I'm sure, were capable of nursing fires. So natural bushfires that may have started, they might have been able to keep them going a bit and capturing the fire. I don't know if you've ever, you know, found, like, moved a fire in a camp, you know, gathered up some sort of smoldering bits from an old fire and moved them to a new place and kept it going and feeding it.
Yeah, I have.
It's easier than, you know, it's easier than starting a fire from scratch.
Yeah.
And so presumably they were able to do that, even if they couldn't start fires. But I don't think it would have been that difficult. I think, you know, there's some teaching involved with starting a fire, and it depends where you are. But I don't think it's that demanding, that it's so multi-step that you need extensive training. I think that's something that probably happened fairly early in our ancestry, the starting of fires, definitely by Homo erectus.
So
I mean, there's no way that a human species could survive hairless and of that size, I don't think, in, you know, in the far north without fire.
So
we have evidence of Homo erectus and of fires in their camps, and we know that Neanderthals also used fires.
Yeah. Amazing. And it sounds like it was such a, you know, a significant influence with regards to our evolution, you know, hence why you've got such a big focus on that, alongside, you know, our the evolution of our brain through socialization and some of the other themes. And from there, we dovetail into the power of storytelling. And I know we touched on that earlier on, as well as me letting you know what a big fan our team at Future Crunch are of your work. So I'm going to share with you actually a little quote from Future Crunch. We share this quite often, and it says, if we want to change the story of the human race in the 21st century, we have to change the stories that we tell ourselves. In the book, you have dedicated a chapter to words and stories based on the idea that stories work as a collective memory bank, storing cultural information encoded in narrative. Hence, if you want to change that story, you must change your own story. In your perspective as both a scientist but also a writer and a storyteller, what is the link between story and human transcendence?
Yeah, stories are a hugely powerful tool. So the one thing that humans do beyond other animals is that our evolution is culturally driven. And what that means is that we pass on to each other not just our genes to the next generation, but we also pass on our stories and knowledge, our cultural knowledge, our skills, our behaviours. And we don't pass them on as static entities. They go through a sort of selection process, and they become added to, and they accumulate. So our culture accumulates. And that allows us as a society to grow more complex, more complex technologies, more complex stories, and so on. And stories are a way of encoding this cultural knowledge about the world and about how our beliefs and about how our society sees itself. But they are not static. So
they also evolve with us.
And we have enormous power to change that story, and it can happen very, very fast. If you think about Australia, until quite recently, there was a whites-only policy on immigration, because Australia saw itself very much as this kind of superior white race, essentially. That story has changed, I'm glad to see. And we recognise that a country isn't made up of people that have to be exactly the same color or religion, or the story can be more complex, it can change. And Australia has become more multicultural. That story of how it sees itself has changed, and that's passed on to the next generations, and they
they very much see themselves as more of a mixture, still a fairly young nation, but a mixture of different backgrounds and ethnicities that create this nation. And that's happened really very fast, actually, if you consider that a lot of people from the white Australia mentality are still part of Australian society today. Mm. So we can change that narrative.
And that loops me back into some of the research I was doing. I was actually watching a video on YouTube of you speaking at a conference. And in the keynote, you were talking about how humans learn as a collective, how we copy each other, and how that creates the bedrock for culture. And what I found really interesting, and this does tie back into what you're saying about storytelling and particularly the example of Australia, is the idea that cultural bias influences how we perceive the world around us. And so I was wondering if you could share some of your insights that you shared in that presentation into the role culture plays in determining our, I want to say our worldview, but, you know, our cultural view, our view of our community, our perception of who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. So we copy everything. So evolution is a process of copying what came before and passing it down. That's how it works. That's how we don't get that kind of chaos of nobody learning anything. We do learn. We learn and we adapt and we pass that information down, and that knowledge accumulates through an evolutionary process. But that does leave us open for bias, obviously, because if we're copying something and we have to, we humans are very, very good at accurate copying. That is what has made us so successful, that we can copy so accurately without making mistakes. It's why we can speak languages, for example. But if we are copying from people in our tribal group, we very much take on this tribal thought, and we think that those beliefs that we're copying are the rational truth, the only way of thinking, and that therefore everybody else is wrong and they have the wrong idea. And this comes down to all sorts of very strange things that we think are completely normal, but actually are completely invented beliefs that we've copied. For everything from using a knife and fork when you eat, we think of as this is the right way to do it, and if you eat with your hands or some other implement, well, that's disgusting, that's wrong, that's like an inferior way of behaving.
You had shared an example.
Someone who behaves in that inferior way is themselves inferior. So we make all these judgments about other people based on something which is completely culturally invented.
You'd shared a really fascinating example, and I think it was a little town in Namibia, maybe. I don't know, but the example
you have to remind me of. Sorry, which example?
Yeah, no. Well, the example you had used was the color green. Yeah. And because culturally they learn about different shades of colour, but there are certain colours, I think it was maybe blue, that they wouldn't even recognise because there's no word for it or symbol for it. And I thought that was actually a really interesting example of cultural bias and what we believe to be true in something as simple as the colour that we see.
Yeah. So, if we don't name things, we quite often don't recognize them. We don't realize them. And so generally in the evolution of color naming, we all start off across the globe. We start off with naming black and white, and then red, and then green, and then other colors come on. So, I mean, for example, the color orange is pretty recent in English. That was called red until quite recently. And pink was also called red. Red was a kind of much broader term. Other countries have different colours, different names for, say, blue. They have, you know, a lighter blue is a completely different named colour than a darker blue and a sort of mid-range blue, which we would just call blue. And if we do differentiate, we use light or dark. They actually have different distinctive names for these. And when we name something, we see it, we perceive it, we recognize it as a thing. So,
so interesting. Yeah, so that's an experiment.
Yeah, so there was an experiment where they've done this in various ways, where they've taken a hunter-gatherer tribe that lives in a forest, where they've shown them a color wheel with various distinctive colors, and the English people can easily perceive the one tile which is different. And I think this was a Namibian group, and the hunter-gatherer tribe couldn't see it because they don't name that as a distinctive color. I think it was a blue, and that comes under the name green for them.
Mm.
So they can't see that as a different color. But what they are very good at is differentiating different shades of green, because in their world, that's much more important, to be able to distinguish different shades. It shows whether something is younger and edible or less edible, and so on.
Mm.
And so if you show that color wheel, they can pick out the odd one out super easily, whereas English speakers can't. They can't see it. They have to see the Pantone color named, you know, to see the difference in the figure. Because we don't have that nuance in our language.
Mm.
And that goes for all kinds of distinctions. So, for example, if somebody knocks a cup over on a table, in English you'd say John knocked the cup off the table. In other languages, I think Japanese is one, they don't identify the subject there. It will be the cup fell off the table. And so when you hear those, when people who are present at the cup being knocked over the table incident are asked afterwards who knocked the cup off the table, English speakers will be easily able to identify it. Whereas other speakers won't, because they find it harder.
Yeah,
because in the sentence in their head doesn't have that accusatory name. So they always kind of, it's a cognitive effort to make that leap, and they have to work it out more easily. And we have this. These cognitive biases in so many different ways. In collective cultures, for example, which a lot of Asian cultures are, they have this more collective mindset, and that's probably evolved because their agriculture is more requires, you know, rice agriculture with the irrigation and so on requires a lot more collective effort. Everyone has to get involved with a rice harvest, whereas in some of the Northern European ones, you can tend your field almost alone, and you don't need so much help, especially if you have a plow. So what's happened has been this development of these different mindsets, and that affects all sorts of things. If you look at eye patterns, eye gaze patterns, when people look at a face, for example, in more individualistic cultures, people tend to focus on the eyes and the mouth, whereas in more collective cultures, their gaze kind of scans the whole face, and they can pick up, they're more able to pick up some more subtle nuances of emotion from that face.
Mm.
I think it's really fascinating.
I could go down such a rabbit hole here. I find it so fascinating.
So many interesting.
Well, just our perception
that we pick up and don't realize,
and our perception of what's real and what we believe to be real. Like, I could just, yeah, I won't jump off that cliff because we could have a whole other podcast about
exactly,
that. I find it fascinating.
Our brains basically have to make up the world. They have to invent the world for us. because they just receive input from our eyes, our nose, our ears and touch and so on. They get these senses and then they have to create this world, which is why we fall for optical illusions really easily and things like that. And that's why jokes work quite often, because we create the story and then we're shown, oh, it's actually this way, you know, and that can be funny or it can be really dangerous. So we're not aware of it because we think it's an external truth, but actually we perceive the world in a very different way than, say, an octopus perceives the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, does that make the world, who has the real world?
Exactly. Yeah. It's such... so interesting. Honestly, I could keep going on and down that road because I find it fascinating. But while we're talking about optical illusions, let's talk about all things beautiful. Again, I know you have a section that's really dedicated to the influence of beauty. And so given that this podcast really has a focus on what we call intelligent optimism, and when I say intelligent optimism, looking at how we can create a better future through focusing on all of the amazing things happening in the world today. And I think beauty really does play its part if we look at it through the lens of intelligent optimism. So I'm wondering, in your experience, how can we use beauty to influence and ignite positive change in the world?
Yeah, so beauty is interesting. Beauty is what beauty really. I use it as this idea that for humans, it's not enough just to survive. We have to have meaning and purpose, and we get that through what I call beauty. So the idea that we intentionally decorate things that don't need decorating. Mm-hmm. It doesn't add to their functionality in any way, but it becomes more pleasing and therefore more valuable. And we trade these valuable items around. They're the bedrock of our societies. Whether these valuable ideas are religions or the concept of money, you know, these are all completely invented by us and given this sort of meaning and value. And they're extremely important in guiding our motivations. And what motivates us is how we survive and how we live. So, these again, because they are invented, we can create them however we like. We choose what we give meaning to. And we've been going through a period of time, fairly recent period of time, where, for example, the consumption model of we need more stuff, it needs to be more shiny and blingy, and the more stuff we have, the better we are as a person, and the more valuable we are, and the more valuable our stuff that we gather is. And that's what's been giving us meaning in recent decades, in recent centuries, in parts of the world. And we need to change that idea of beauty. We need to recognize that we are part of the natural world.
And, so true. Your work is really a testament to that.
Well, it's really important to recognize before it's too late, before we don't have a useful natural world, that the way this sort of linear model of consumption, where something is created from the natural world, and made in a form that can't then be recycled or returned to the natural world easily, which is where we all live. We all live in the natural world. We don't live in this kind of artificial construct apart from the earth. We are part of the earth, and we return our everything we use and make to the earth. So if we take that circularity out and turn it into this linear process, which is what we have been doing, you know, this is going to end in our destruction, not least the destruction of our societies quite quickly. And we need to change that model of beauty and recognize that things that what is beautiful is also what sustains us.
Mm.
And yeah, I think that process has started. It's very, it's completely innate and intrinsic to the societies of many Indigenous people. Mm. This is how they live their lives, and it's how we lived our lives until you know, relatively recently, if we look on the evolutionary timetable of all of humans. But that model has changed, and we need to revisit the beauty of other cultures and recognize that is actually that model of beauty is more sustainable.
Yeah. Do you think we're starting to see a backswing with, you know, say rewilding of the cities and people sort of maybe as a result of the pandemic, for example, returning to community living and walking more? And are some of those trends, do you think that we're going in the right direction, I guess, is my question?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've learnt a lot through some of the hardships we've faced. What's important, you know, is it important to just order loads of crap off the internet constantly and just fill our houses with stuff? Is that important? Or is it actually, what do we get joy and pleasure from? It's quite often just, you know, a 15-minute walk where you just have this kind of connection with a bird, or
it's so true.
You just, yeah, you know, a few minutes just to suddenly kind of appreciate a view that you hadn't, you know, is looking particularly lovely or different or transformed, or just moments spent with people that have meaning for you. You know, these are the things that you really get value from, and they're also things that don't end up, you know, adding to pollution. So that's quite a win. And I think we all appreciate, you know, we appreciate that cleaner air, cleaner water. You know, I think we've been willing to give up too much of that in the bid for, you know, a successful city. And, you know, it doesn't have to be like that. Mm. You know, we've put up with disgusting air quality, or you know, smogs and things like that. When we don't, you know, it doesn't have to be like that. We can, we can enjoy, you know, we can enjoy sort of high technically advanced societies without so much of the negative.
So we're now getting to towards the end of the podcast, second last question, in fact. And the reason I know that is because as a human being, I have an ability to be a timekeeper. I have an intuitive sense of time and also intellectual ways to track time. Now, we have traversed through time to transcend in terms of our evolution. Yet, you know, we also have the ability to travel through time via memories and emotions. Now, I get that this is a really big topic, but I'm curious to understand what makes time meaningful in the journey of human evolution.
Yeah, so time is particularly interesting concept for people, because we are able to imagine a time before we existed, look back, and we're also able to plan. We know that if we have sex, there's a chance that in 9 months' time we'll have a baby. We know that if we plant a seed, we might get a plant at the end of it. We know that seasons repeat, not just innately. You know, it's not just a it's not something that is a sort of an inbuilt impulse like it is for birds, say. We know, and we can plan for seasonality. And we also know that one day we will die.
Mm.
Even if we don't live with that knowledge at the forefront of our minds, and a lot of us are in denial, we nevertheless know that's going to happen. And that changes things about the way that we behave. And this knowledge of time allows us to do things like store things, and prepare for disasters, and plan for our future, that sort of thing. But it's also a different way of looking at the world. It's a way of looking at the world as though there is an objective truth about it, apart from our subjective knowledge of the world. So what we were talking about before, meaning and beauty, that's a very subjective view. You know, if I say you need to eat with a knife and fork, that isn't the only way to eat. That's just my opinion of how you must eat. Whereas if I say, the sun becomes warm, the days grow longer in the summer, that is an objective truth. You can't argue with that. It is going to happen. The days will become longer in the summer. And this, humans have this kind of urge to also discover objective truths about the world, to better understand their world, which allows us to develop technologies more intelligently than just trial and error. We can actually understand fundamentally how the world works through scientific principles, which allows us to develop much more complex ways of using our technologies, of ways of understanding the world and planning. And that's what's taken us to the moon and to Venus and so on. This very different understanding of the world. And that is what has allowed us to change life itself, change ourselves. We can now genetically manipulate bacteria, people. The mRNA vaccines are a result of a long process of humans saying, no, there is an objective truth about the world, and I want to find out what it is. I want to find out exactly how this does work. The story about how each planet has its personality and travels around the world is all very interesting, but I want to find out the real truth about what actually holds those planets in place and the actual system that they're going to follow, and what is going on that's too small for my eyes to perceive in my body and in cells, and to really understand the world, the scientific revolution. But that began before we have it's not the scientific revolution that we all talk about as the scientific revolution, you know, with that happened 500 years ago or whatever, was of course a big leap in our understanding, but this pursuit of knowledge, of scientific knowledge, goes back to prehistory. We can see calendars carved onto eagle bones made by people during the Pleistocene. The caves in Lascaux in France show an understanding of the solar system that they could only have got through really patient generational observations of the movements of the celestial bodies. And so this idea that we're not satisfied by a story or just by saying, oh, it's fate, these things happen, and is not enough. We're curious, and we're curious enough to investigate it and try and find some sort of truth about the world. And that's hugely important to humans, and it's transformed our world. That's what's brought us into the Anthropocene, this idea that we can see what the truth of the world is and then change it and make our own world. And that's what we've done.
Fascinating. And I have to say, I have the privilege, which my listeners won't have, of seeing you here on Zoom, and it's so wonderful seeing you talk about a subject that you so clearly are passionate about, and to see that fire in you, I feel actually quite honoured to be able to experience your storytelling here live with you. So I'm sure that will translate through the podcast as well, but I'm hanging on every word here. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about it.
Well, I have come to my last question today, and to be honest, I feel like I've only skimmed the surface of this incredible book, but given what we have discussed today and in the context of the Anthropocene, where do we go from here? And where does all of this land in the context of creating a better future?
Well, I think it comes right back to the beginning, what I was talking about right at the very beginning of how evolution works, and that's through cooperation. We cannot solve these global problems unless we collaborate. You know, you can recycle as many pieces of paper as you like. That's not going to change global warming. And we have enormous problems. We have huge injustice and poverty in the world. We have climate change. We have biodiversity loss. We have global pandemics. And we have just natural disasters that occur anyway. And we solve those problems through collaboration, through cooperative effort, through people coming together with often complete strangers to come up with solutions and ways for others to survive. And that makes us stronger. And that's it. And we do that in our modern societies through voting, where we have democracies, and that's where our power lies as individuals and as a collective. So we can vote for people who are going to make the changes that we want to see to the world. We can change the world, and we can do it peacefully and collaboratively. That's the beauty, I think, of democracy, which again is an invention of ours, a beautiful invention.
And we certainly will change the world with more voices and stories from people like you. So thank you so much for joining me on today's podcast. I am sure I have a ton of listeners who want to track you down online somewhere. So I'm wondering if you could maybe share your website details and where we can buy either the Anthropocy or Transcendence. Where can we buy your books?
Yeah, so they're all available. So my website is wanderinggaia.com, and Adventures in the Anthropocene and also Transcendence are both available in Australia from all your good bookshops and online. Do you have Amazon now? You have Amazon, right?
We do. In fact, I obviously bought Transcendence, and I think it came up on about 5 or 6 different online bookstores. So it's not hard to find.
It's available there. Yeah. It's Penguin.
Excellent.
Penguin Australia.
Thank you so much for joining me on the DNA of Purpose podcast, Gaia Vince.
Big pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like updates on upcoming episodes as they are released, in addition to good news posts from the world of science and technology, please follow along at our Instagram page, which is at DNA of Purpose Podcast, or sign up to our newsletter at futurecrunch.com. You can also download our brand new ebook on the Great Transformation, which is available at our website. And these links are also included in the show notes. You can think of the Great Transformation document as your field guide to the next economy.